Shopomaniacs, you're listening to episode 440 of the Shop Talk Show. I'm Dave Rupert. With me is Chris Coyer. Chris, we are 440 years old today. How are you feeling?
I feel about 440. Actually, I've been feeling a little bit better, honestly, because I've had a rough year with the arm breaking and then the back trouble, and then I get hit by a car and yada, yada. So the last thing wrong with me is my left foot, and I'd say it's 70% healed, and I'm back doing some mask wearing personal training and stuff and feeling good about that. I need to, fix the diet again. That was good for a while and now it's off again. Oh, it's always a struggle, but in the grand scheme of things, I'm feeling pretty darn good today.
I don't understand diets. What's the deal with diets? I over the pandemic, I have like basically given up Diet Coke. Like it's basically gone.
You're a hero. Right?
I'm not going to get the virus just for a Diet Coke. Listen, I like Diet Coke, but I'm not going to get the virus for it. I'm having smoothies for breakfast. I take the dog for walks in the middle of the day because whatever, I'm stress. And then, I don't drink beer that much. I just basically like given up on it because it's like the calories per fun are so out of whack. And so like, as a parent, you're just like, well, I'm not going to get fully blitzed or whatever, cause I also have to take care of children.
Yeah. Tricky.
So like so the calories per fun are out. And so it's like, two beers a week or something like that, really just not much at all. And so I'm just like, it's just this, like I've eliminated all these, vices, if you will, and the things people are like, oh, that makes you fat. But I'm not seeing any results. So I don't know what's going on. I'm having got a Vitamix, eating smoothies for breakfast. I just don't even know what's going on, man. So you think I would have some return on this investment, but it's just not working out. So
I'm sorry, man. That's all right. Yeah, well, some of it's...
I don't understand.
Maybe you'll just like delay the year that we all inevitably get cancer or whatever, There's some of that too. Yeah,
push it all back. Just a year or two. So,
all right. Well, you mentioned serverless before the show. That's always been something I kind of keep my eye on. I don't think I'm a professional in it by any means, but it felt right when it started to be a little industry zeitgeist thing. Like, oh, this is clever, and it really hasn't gone away. In fact, it's nothing but gotten bigger and better over the years. So, I know it's a little bit of a buzzword, but I don't know. Are you dabbling recently or what?
So I'm building a little product, a little side product thing. And it's, I'm kind of buying into Jamstack, right? Like if I would have built this in Rails, it would have been done and done a long time ago. So, whoops. But, I think this idea is like kind of getting into like, how can I future-proof myself? I think I've maybe said it before on the show, but like I've built something in Rails and like it's cool, but then all the development kind of lands on my shoulders, and then spinning up the environment's hard and stuff like that. I found like with, sites like 11D sites and Nuxt is very close to 11D or Jekyll or something like that in its structure.
Really?
Like I can give that. Yeah. Just the file structure is very similar, but then, in even the sort of,
I guess you're right,
metaphors of pages and stuff like that, that it's using.
Yeah. It's like put stuff in folders and pages and we'll build the site structure based on that. I guess that's kind of how they both work. I didn't really think of them as connected like that, but they are.
No, they're pretty similar. And so so I've had success, I would say, like with my coworkers, who are mostly in the design camp, but success with like getting them spinning this up locally and working on this little thing we're building. And then, it comes time to, we're deploying to Netlify just for like, so we can like make branch deploys and previews and all this stuff. Like you get a lot of benefits being in the Jamstack ecosystem, right?
I think so.
And then it comes to the data part, right? Like, so we want to add stuff via forms, and so when you get into that, it starts like getting more difficult because the architecture I'm kind of landing on is, and I can tell you a 2,000 word story about my journey into GraphQL, but I'll pause for a minute just to say, like, what you kind of realize is, like, in your Nuxt app needs to call some kind of server that has all the API keys or something that only lets the Nuxt app or whatever call it, and then it'll spit out and call the actual database, right? Like, there's sort of a chain that happens.
Yeah, you write your own little CRUD functions, yeah.
You write your CRUD functions. And so in a Netlify world, those CRUD things happen on the serverless in your Netlify functions folder.
Yeah, in your functions folder, yep.
So you end up like writing a bunch of functions, and this is kind of my first question. But it's like page get all or get all pages, or, you know, what would be a better function? Get all posts. There you go. That's the blog. We'll do the blog.
Right.
And then get all post comments when you pass it a post ID or something like that. Or get all, or get single, get one page or whatever. Whatever you want to call your functions, they're like that. But I just kind of like, you know, I'm working in this and I'm like, I'm repeating myself a lot, like doing a lot of handler calls. And then I'm just doing one thing, like fetching one thing from the database and then spitting it back out. And I kind of was like, you know, is the concept of doing CRUD, like a Rails controller inside your serverless function, is that a thing or is that a dumb thing? So,
if you're working with REST APIs, I don't know that you have much choice. You know, you got to write some kind of handler for the things. But GraphQL kind of opens it up a little bit in that you don't write a get all posts.js file. You just have like one GraphQL handler and it just executes whatever GraphQL ask that you have of it.
Right. So, but don't you have to like write like resolvers and stuff like that? Or you're like in the client, you're writing the GraphQL or is it in the API data layer that you're writing the GraphQL?
No, I think it could go either way, you know, but it sounds like you're doing most, it's a client side stuff mostly. Yeah. Or are you trying to get it to do on build?
Doing it all client side mostly. Yeah. So mostly just client side.
I think it just depends a lot of where the data is going and what service it is and how much that service wants to help you with that data. You know, there's like Contentful, and Contentful is very UI driven, and you can scaffold out your data on Contentful and be like, this is what my data is like. And it gives you these GraphQL endpoints. And in that case, you're not hitting a Netlify function at all, really. You're just doing it right. You're skipping right, hitting their APIs. Probably. I don't know how the API key thing works there. There must be something. Maybe you do need one little middleman to scoot through it. I don't know. But then there's then there's stuff like, what is it? What's the whole list of them? Hasura and Fauna and Amplify's data store thing. And they all have a little different philosophy. Some of them, if you really want GraphQL, you write a GraphQL schema that's in your code base and that structures the data on their side. And I think it really depends on which service you're using for that data, how it wants you to interface with that. It doesn't feel right that you'd have to structure all your data and then write a whole bunch of individual Netlify functions for every possible request you have. It does seem like a lot of repeating yourself, but I don't know.
Yeah, because my thought is like, I either make a get, like a fetch get or a fetch post within some content, and then it figures out what to do with it or how to write that data to a database. And I guess I should say, like, I ended up opting out of GraphQL because I didn't like it. And that's maybe a controversial opinion, but it's not my favorite. And I can give like more in-depth reasons, but I settled on this thing called Prisma, which is what Redwood JS uses.
Okay.
Sort of by default, but it's sort of this ORM, like almost like Rails Active Record style ORM to like basically scaffold out your database. Like you write almost like a schema, almost like a GraphQL schema, exactly. But you write a schema and then you use that schema to generate your database for you and stuff. Like you can like do migrations and stuff like that. Like, I like that aspect of it. But then just even like it's how it grabs stuff from the database is pretty cool. So, and maybe that's like the trade-off I'm making. But
so I think that sounds cool. I don't have as much experience with, but it sounds like it's matching your kind of mental model nicely. And
yeah, just even how I want to develop and stuff like that. I think I took a GraphQL course even over at jams.conf because I just was like, you know, I need to fill in some holes of my understanding. And it was educational, but it was like, you realize the GraphQL landscape is ginormous, you know? There's like a map somewhere that has it all, but yeah, it's like this just enormous landscape of all this stuff,
yeah.
That you kind of need to know. And it sort of was like this, like, okay, I want data. It's like, cool. You want data? Well, you need a GraphQL. And then you have to like write your GraphQL query. And then you want that? Well, you need like Graphicool or whatever to play with that. But then you need like your GraphQL. And then you need to like write a resolver, right? And that resolver tells you what to do with the data. And then like once you have the data, then you have the, like, it felt like I was putting like four or five different appliances in front of like just getting data. And
yes,
that's what I'm trying to figure out. Is like,
I wonder if it works better in like larger teams where that responsibility is split out to the people that kind of want that responsibility. I'm not sure if that's kind of a baby thought, but I wrote a bunch of GraphQL this morning because we upgraded to Apollo Client 3 at CodePen, and it's fast moving and early enough of technology that they do stuff that seems crazy, like to break a bunch of APIs and totally stop supporting big components that you'd think. So the way they used to write it in React is you'd have a query component, you know, like angle bracket query, and you'd call a query, and then, you know, you'd put the query information in there and variables that you're going to pass it and all that stuff. And then it's like a render function, or I forget what the right vernacular for all that, but you have some props that you can work with, like data. So the result of the data comes back, and you can use that in your templating, very handy. But also other stuff like the state that it's in, like a loading state. So if this loading is true, that means you don't have the data yet. So render a skeleton or something, you know, which is felt like a modern way to do stuff. Then this new client comes out, and the query components they're deprecated. No more query components.
That's a big change.
Yeah, it's a big change. What the heck?
So is it now using a cooks? Like,
yeah,
use data or something?
Use query. So
use query. Okay.
Yep. Okay. So cool. We got use query. We can refactor. It's not the hardest thing in the world. In fact, I only have like four or five left. I think I got to write this morning, and then we'll be totally off the query components. Thank God, you know, and on the latest and greatest. It feels good. We're pretty hook based anyway. So having all of our hook stuff all.
Yeah, I was going to say, if you weren't even at that point? What if you're still React classes? You're still in React 14 land.
I don't know. Yeah, I think you don't upgrade to this, then you just stay on the old one. I don't know what that story is, but you know, we like to stay on the latest and greatest. So whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
We're there. And then another change I was doing was one of the things you can do is put the query right in use query, or have like, you know, one like GQL backtick thing, and or just have the stuff in there. But if you break it out into a .graphql file, your queries instead, and like then import them like Webpack style or, you know, Bundler style, you can then lint those files, which is kind of cool. So you can set up like GraphQL linting that says like, and you know, any file that ends in GraphQL, like here's some rules that I want to make sure site-wide we do. So that was another refactor we did, is break all of our queries into .graphql files and mutations so that we can apply linting to them, make sure we're not making weird mistakes. Some of those are really important. For example, in Apollo Client 3, they said every single like thing that you pull needs an ID for caching reasons, which is totally fine. That makes sense. You know, the cache should have an ID to match stuff to. I don't know how it worked before, but we found lots of places in our app that didn't have an ID in the query, and it would cause weird caching things. So in that upgrade, having a lint rule for that was very useful for us and stuff. But I don't write the resolvers. I don't write anything. I'm at one slice of this level, and Dave, you're rolling in and you need to be on all the levels. You're writing all of it, and I don't envy that. I think I would be much more lost than you are with all that, and might come to the same conclusion if I had to.
You know, it's interesting. Like, as somebody who has decades of CRUD app experience, it was like, this is a lot of action to set up, a lot more than maybe I thought it was going to be. And so, which is, you know, what a naivete on my part. But, you know, I think when I settled on this appliances metaphor, I think that like really, like, you know, you said Apollo server and Apollo client, like those are other appliances you have to kind of know, you know, like to get the data flow to happen from your data store. And so, so it opened my eyes. I think it's still cool, but it felt like a little smidge repetitive. Like you have to do it at this layer and then you have to do it at this layer and then you have to do it. So I was trying to.
Okay. I mean, the stuff changes. Even if you did decided against it now, it doesn't mean you'll never use it. I mean, maybe if the app gets absolutely humongous one day, you'll reevaluate things and see value there, or maybe you never will. I don't know.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. Yeah. Things can change over time. I can tell you one of the things I like is the robust feeling of it. Like even if it feels a little verbose, it's easy to kind of trace what's happening. It feels like there's a lot of control also. And honestly, it's one of the things I like about React, and I know you don't even like React, but I think this would be true in any JavaScript framework for the most part, is feeling how I'm describing what I want this interface to do and it just does it and it never breaks. Like never do we have a bug that's like, if you click the button, it doesn't do the thing that it's supposed to do when you click the button. Like that's never a bug in our app because there's a button and it has an unclick handler and the unclick handler does the job that it's supposed to do. You know, it feels very sturdy. Maybe that's a better word.
Yeah, I guess, isolated, right? Like you don't, and I think I like that part of it too. I just did a thing like on form validation. Like I used to do the 6 lines of JavaScript just to get like a weird, you know, form validation with HTML attributes and stuff like that.
Good job.
Yeah. Or like, it's more like when the invalid event fires on the input, you know, then like put an error state and then I can style the error state because the way CSS works, it's invalid when the page loads, you know, and so you don't actually want that. You want it to show up later, right?
Ooh.
After submit. And so, you know, and historically I've reached for like jQuery validate or something like that. And then I was like, I'm just going to do it in like 6 lines of JavaScript, did that. But now in Vue, it's like doing a bunch of like query selector all feels like really stupid. So I figured out a way just to do it without it. And it's pretty simple, but it's, you know, it's using like directives instead that do all the query selectors and add event listener sort of stuff. But yeah, it's nice because it's all contained. You know, I do like suffer from a little repetitiveness. Like if I'm component one and or page one in Nuxt and page two are very similar, like, and they both have forms, and I want validation on both forms, you end up with like a little bit of repetitiveness. But, you know, there may be a way I can optimize that out with, you know, some, who knows, like, I don't want to do a wrapper component, like you said, like you suggested, because I don't know, wrapper components give me like bad vibes for some reason. It's just because you open the door to one, it's 16, you know, cousins are going to show up with it. But no, it's just sort of more like it's like I don't know. You're building a dependency tree, you know, and it's like this thing is now dependent on this, you know. So,
how's Prisma going? Are you feeling pretty
Prisma,
good?
Prisma, I really like. I wish it was like the thing. You know, it's weird when you're not using the thing. You know what I mean? Like, you feel like, am I doing it wrong if I'm not I have a fly. I'm not doing it wrong if I like am not doing the GraphQL thing, but. It feels like you're doing a wrong culturally, but it's actually pretty great. And the docs are wonderful. The development is wonderful. You know, I think it is like venture backed. So by like Tom Preston Warner. So that's kind of cool. But like, it just sort of tells me like it's, he's using it and it will be around for a bit. So that's kind of cool. But I think it's a different approach to getting data out of your database. And that's sort of the one thing they do, and this is sort of like where the other question I sort of have about all this is like, one thing they do is they say like, just use SQLite for like local development or whatever, you know, like they offer that.
Okay.
Which is kind of cool, 'cause you can use like Node NPM to do SQLite, right? Like it installs. Yeah,
not to mention that everybody else working on the project with you stays in sync data wise, which is pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And we've had a few like syncing problems, like somebody will add data and then it'll get stomped by somebody else because it's like a compiled file. It's like a almost like your SAS file, right?
Oh, it's like so binary. Like,
yeah, yeah. So it's sort of like a compiled file. So so I'm kind of just like, how do people like, what's the best way to work with local databases, local data? You know, like, I mean, you can like download and then, you know, get somebody set up on a full friggin' MySQL thing and MAMP or whatever, and then hopefully that never breaks or disconnects, and then they have to run the dbseed command or whatever, you know. I'm just...
Oh, yeah. It's tricky. It's tricky. At CodePen, Alex wrote a thing called SSDB, Super Slim Database. And so it's Rails, so we have that going on, which means, you know, Active Record and whatever, you know, like like if there's a migration, you just run it, and that actually with our dev environment, those just run automatically. It's pretty nice, you know, but it doesn't solve syncing really, you know, like what if you need like a new clean set of data to work with in your database? Rails doesn't help you with that, you know. Yeah. I don't know. So he's got this script and we just run it. It's like a, you know, he made a little command line utility and it has a config file, which largely you don't need to change, but it has some cool stuff that you can change in it. For example, there's just like a YAML thing and you can put somebody's username in it. If I wanted to pull Dave's data, you know, I just put your username in there and then next time I run it, I'll have a full copy of you locally.
Oh, okay.
But it makes some smart defaults, you know, like all of Team CodePen is on there and there's certain popularity stuff and a random smattering of collections and all this stuff. But the idea is that it'll be, you know, 0.001% size of our production database. It's just enough stuff that it's useful locally, but it runs in like 3 minutes, you know, or less, you know, it's really fast to run. So it's like if there's a particular customer and they have a problem with their account, we can get an exact copy of that customer by putting their name in the file, running SSDB, and then we got them, you know. But it's totally hand-rolled. Like no service helps us with this at all. It had to be handwritten.
Okay. Well, that's good to know. I'm just like the you know, local development is a thing. We all do it, right? But then you're like, when it comes to local data, people are like, "Oh, talk to Jeff data, you know, or what?" Like, it's such a manual thing. There's no like NPM installed database that I have found yet. You know, like SQLite kind of does it, you know, but like you can't really like NPM install Postgres or something major serious, you know.
I've always wondered, like, what if you stop caring about offline development entirely? You're like, well, if I'm on a plane, I just can't work on it. Why couldn't everybody locally connect to like a staging DB or a development DB, but that just is cloud hosted? Because you can even do serverless. Right. Like, why wouldn't that just be nice? And you can just be like, then nobody has to sync anything. It just connects to that.
Well, I've thought of that too. And I've actually been in enterprise situations that do that. The problem is when like, when somebody makes big changes to development 1.db or database, you know, and then whoever was working on development 1 database as well, they got just nuked entirely, you know. So but maybe the solution is like you get your own cloud data instance, right? Like your own, everyone gets their own, and then there's a set of migration tools to like, I don't know, to like copy data or ferry data around or something just to get from one to another. I don't like, I'm trying to imagine what the world would be like. What would be my ideal working with local data setup, you know, almost like, what our favorite, WordPress Delicious Brains.
Yeah, WP DB Migrate Pro. I still use that crap all the time.
It's, you know, so like, useful, yeah. Like you're like, oh, I want the one on the cloud. I want you to put it on my machine and fix all the routes or whatever.
It's yeah. Like,
done.
I would say like if as long as we're pie in the sky, I do want a full copy. Like that's a little, yeah. That's like just like not happening on CodePen because it's like just trilobytes of
terabytes. Yeah, yeah.
Very large. But ideally that's what it would be. Ideally, it would like be an exact replica of production 2 minutes behind or something, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and could you do that? You know, like just like, I don't know, like just click a button and say like snapshot here, give it to me, you know? Like
I think there's other considerations though, too. There's kind of like that, you almost want data that doesn't change too much for testing purposes sometimes, you know, right? So...
Well, shoot, that's another thing, right? Like you want different data to test with, right? Like I want some malformatted markdown post in my data set so that I can test bad markdown.
Yeah, you know, and you don't want some other developer to just like, I don't know, fix it or something, not knowing the implications of that. So like...
Yeah, yeah.
It's or all like, tricky.
I don't know. I'm curious what people are finding or...
This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you by Automattic. You know, we talk about them all the time. Jetpack, WooCommerce, WordPress.com, a bunch of other products. They've started producing courses about WordPress itself at WPCourses.com. There'll be a link in the show notes, of course. So their very first course is called Blogging for Beginners. So if you're out there and you're listening to this and you're like new to the world of making websites and interested in the world of blogging, certainly a world I'm very interested in. I've had a lot of luck and success and joy and pleasure and everything from blogging over the years. If you just want a course to get you up to speed, what's it all about? How do you do it? This is the course to take. It's $49. There is office hours sessions so you can ask questions as well as, of course, the course itself. But then in addition to that, you get these quarterly sessions led by WordPress product experts. Really cool. Looks like they're really committed to doing a good job with this over time, you know, and you can check out the syllabus online and all that kind of thing. It's $49 again for the course Blogging for Beginners, and it's just their first course. They've listed an upcoming course called Podcasting for Beginners. So if you're interested in the world of podcasting, certainly keep your eye on that one. And it serves as a good reminder that you can run a podcast on WordPress.com in case you didn't know. So that's pretty compelling too. Interesting world for them to be in. So high five Automattic Game for getting this out the door. Hot off the presses, WPCourses.com. Well, now that you're writing some Netlify functions and stuff for your CRUD stuff, Is this like the first time you've done a lot of that?
You know, this is my first like big, yeah, baby writes his first function situation. Like I'm definitely like all in. I'm trying to be all in on this, but you know, it's very easy to be like, oh, if we just had a little node server here, you know, $5 a month, we could just kind of do it.
Use Vercel or something. Yeah.
No, you totally can. And Netlify has other products like background functions or something, you know, stuff like that and stuff like that. But I'm just trying to like keep the overhead as simple as possible and kind of like almost lightweight or like you could almost like run this application like your own instance or for another client or whatever, like just with like changing some like config keys, basically like API keys or whatever. Like you could basically just like, you know, kind of like offload this to, or you could like just whatever, hot swap some variables, some environment variables, and then like it's running a whole new clean instance or whatever. So that's sort of the target goal. But then even like with the idea, like the constraint that I want like my coworkers to be able to work on it, which is maybe unfair to everybody else, but it's just the idea of like, I want it to be easy to work on because if at a 3-person company, if I make it really hard for 2 other people to work on it, again, it becomes my problem. You know, like now it's all Dave Rupert's problems. So, but the Netlify functions are they make that really easy to work with. So
yeah, I like how they have a deployment story, which is otherwise you got to all configure yourself, you know, like there's some tools like serverless.com that it helps with that, but, and there's, you know, there's a couple other contenders for that, but it's still non-trivial. It literally is trivial on Netlify. Put the freaking node function in a folder and deploy it, and that's, and you're done.
And tell it what folder you want. Yeah.
That's stupid easy. The background thing is interesting. They just released that, but all it does is just ups the thing from 10 seconds to 15 minutes, like how long it can run. This is not like a total sea change.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not the, it's just a limit of the amount of time, but you know, there, that's something.
Oh yeah, it's a big deal. It means they're eating some more costs for us. Thanks, Netlify.
Yeah, you get a little 15-minute node server. That's kind of cool.
It is cool. That's very nice. But it's not like always running. That's different. You know, if you need like a thing that just responds to any request with Node, that's like a different story a little bit.
Right. And, you know, maybe that's like a, again, like that's a, like a dedicated endpoint or something like that. So
are you starting to see, and they don't, Netlify's got a beta of Edge functions too, right?
I believe so. Yeah.
Those are out now.
Like, kind of like start manipulating stuff with the context, right?
Right. That's, I just mean, I wonder if that's showing up in your brain too. It's like, oh, I wrote this as a function, meaning that function, if it's in your functions folder, now you have a URL to hit it. But the Edge functions, they don't need a URL because they just run on the request. They just automatically run and you can do stuff. So I wonder if your brain, you'll start chewing on that pretty soon.
No, because I mean, you could kind of like prefetch data basically, right? Like, because you're saving a...
Yeah.
Because like in the client, you say like, okay, render the whole client. Okay, now that that's on mounted or whatever, now do a fetch request. You know, you could almost be like, peace out, like I know this thing's gonna do a fetch request, so I'm just gonna
at some particular URL function. Like if it's the home page, maybe not, but if it's /product/red/page3, you damn well know what query it's gonna run. You should just run it at run it in the handler, you know,
at it there. No, that's a good point. But that's maybe kind of too far out probably for us, just and like again, it's something can everybody work on, you know. So No, it's so far so good. I'm just kind of like I'm really like I'm on the lookout, and if listeners have any links, like stories of where people are like purely serverless, you know what I mean? Like not, you know, like, and maybe like part of Jamstack is like, you can just be whatever, man. But like, it's very pluralistic. But like, you know, is somebody who's like, we went on a fully serverless architecture and we're not doing, we don't have like a hidden whatever API server anywhere. Or a lot of the Jamstack case studies are like, we pulled down information from our BigCommerce or our Shopify API, you know? And so it's like, well, that's like a node server running somewhere. Like, you know, like just because you don't own that node server, it doesn't make it not a node server or whatever. Yeah. So like is, but like purely serverless architectures is sort of what I'm interested in, you know?
Yeah, you went all in, you know, you don't hear that much. Even when we had Brian from Begin on, he said, that's not normal. It's more normal to piecemeal things.
I would be curious what if there's any good purely serverless stories. That's sort of what we're trying. We'll see how long it lasts, but you know,
I heard a little conversation. God, it was you know, Swix and Ryan Florence maybe talking about like, are the Edge functions things going to supersede some of serverless usage entirely? And he made some analogy like some other like VHS to streaming or something and skipped over Blu-ray kind of like blue years of like, you know, some cheesy like that. But I wonder if it'll pan out like a hierarchy was my kind of response to that. Like if you can run it at an Edge handler, then do it. If you can, 'cause usually there's benefit there, but there's a lot of limitations to that. So if you can't, then step down to another level, which is maybe like a serverless function. But then is there limits to that too, like how long it runs or whatever, and then step to something else? And then it was is kind of confused by the idea that I think when you write a serverless function like you, Dave, when you write one of those functions and put it in a folder and deploy it, it's deployed to like one zone. It's deployed one to like zone. Iowa or
AWS
something.
East.
Yeah. Or whatever. But Lambda does have, and other services too, it's not a uniquely Amazon thing, edge versions of their serverless functions. They're just more expensive. So you have to decide, can I ship it to everywhere or not? Is it worth it? Is the cost effective to do that? So there'll be like eventually there'll be like a pretty clear mental chart of like what do you pick and when.
Yeah, like that's hard for me to, because you're like, I'm just building the thing, you know, but then you're like, wait a minute, I have to decide where it runs too, like exactly, you know, this 8 lines of node, like where does it run? You know, that's a lot of mental overhead.
It sure is right now. Yet another thing that's like, feel like it's cool that it opened the door to front end developers, but I don't know how to think about that stuff. I don't know how to price it all out and know how it affects performance. And I just like don't think about it at all. I'd like to not have to. And I think that's where it's kind of going. You know, watching AWS for a decade, they are amazing at, and other companies are too, but I really think this exemplifies AWS. They're constantly making it better. Like like significantly better, and releasing the betterness and telling you, and oftentimes it's better and cheaper, and they're just like, here you go, we just shipped it, it's now better and cheaper, and it's very easy to clear and to map out and look and be like, holy crap, that's just way better than it used to be, thanks, you know, I didn't even have to write anything to make it better. So it seems like if that's been the case for so long now, what else is going to get better? Well, probably the global CDN stuff. Like maybe we'll get to a point where you don't have to ask Amazon to please run my Lambdas in multiple zones or all zones. It'll just do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. That's
That'd be cool.
Yeah. I'm curious where that goes. I you know, Brian LaRue, who you mentioned earlier from Begin, he like follows all this stuff. And it's interesting, like, when he's at these AWS conferences, he's just like, oh, wow, they just made that faster. Like every story is like, yeah, it's serverless, but it's like the cold start went down or whatever, you know? And so it's just.
Yeah, exactly. Or the CPUs that run on went ARM, so they're better for these things or who knows what.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. And so like, no, I'm like, oh, that's speaking of, I think that Apple thing's happening, but the like, you know, there's all this, it's a lot of overhead. It's getting to be a lot of overhead, but it is very interesting what gains you can make. So what would you do if you did a fetch request on the edge handler? Would you just pass it back in like a header or something? What would
the
like,
data,
or
of
would
it?
You like, yeah, would you,
I would try to manipulate the HTML right there.
Like and drop a script tag at the bottom or something.
Because you have maybe if it's
or the head.
I mean, that's kind of clever, but it's like, why you already do you, like, I'm imagining that you get data that's like avatar URL and a user ID and just stuff. You probably already know what you want to do with that stuff, so just do it right then. Like if you have to do a query selector all and find an image tag and replace the image source, do it then. Like literally manipulate the HTML before it responds. That way it doesn't, like, the request doesn't come down and then client side JavaScript has to pick it up and do something with it. That work has already been done. Now that's assuming a lot about what you intend to do with that information. I get what you're saying. It might be nice to just blop some JSON onto the page so that client side JavaScript just has it and knows what to do with it and can use it from there. That's probably fine. But if you can just do the work at the cloud, do the work elsewhere.
That's interesting. I wonder how easy that would be, because I mean, in theory, you could just send your React app up to the cloud function and it has access and it could render it a string or whatever for,
right? I mean, that's what, in that Brian episode, that's what he's saying. He's like, this is, and then it's cached too, like you can run that fetch, but you you might know enough based on headers that you don't even have to run the fetch. You could just be like, oh, I've already done this once. Please get it from cache instead.
Yeah.
Which is kind of cool and clever. And you, or you might even know that based on the URL. You know, it's like really an architecture level decisions. You might be like, this doesn't change that often. So just always fetch it from cache at this URL or whatever.
Hmm.
It's like a service worker in the sky.
Service worker, and that's my favorite Creedence Clearwater Revival song. Service worker in the sky.
Got a good job in the cloud. This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you in part by Netlify. Ooh, Netlify is the best. So easy. They make deployment so easy. It's such a pleasure to like have some files on your local computer, even just static stuff that you're just authoring by hand, or you're playing around with a static site generator or anything like that. And you have it and it's like a nice local dev environment, super comfortable. And you're like, maybe I'll put this live. It's already a Git repo. So I'll, you know, tell Netlify to look at this repo, run this build command. This folder is the one I want to be the live site, and I'm done. And it's super fast. And every time I push to the master branch on that repo or any other branch that I specify, it's immediately live and I see previews of the pull requests against it. What? It's so easy. It has really like gotten us spoiled as developers of how good a deployment, like a CI/CD kind of world, can be. And so you can also run backend stuff if you need to, you know, like, sure, it's static hosting, but if you want to run like some node code on the backend, fine. Just make a folder called functions, throw your node or Go code in there, and it'll deploy them as AWS Lambdas with nice little like local URLs you can hit, so you're not worrying about cores or stuff like that, and run your backend code too. And now if you append dash background to those files, like my function dash background.js, they'll run up to 15 minutes, which is like the limit of AWS Lambda period, meaning like you could spin up a headless browser with Puppeteer and like visit a bunch of URLs and make PDFs out of them and then store them in storage and email them somewhere else. Do long running stuff, because if you don't do the dash background thing, you only have 10 seconds and you might get Puppeteer started up. But if you try to take a bunch of screenshots or something, you might bump into that limit. So background functions are where it's at. Thanks, Netlify.
Hey, we got some questions, I think, here. We are a question and answer podcast. You might have missed that for the last pandemic. But hey, we do have a question. Should we jump over to this?
Sure,
here,
yeah,
Chris?
Do it.
Here we go. Got a question from Eric Butler. Writes in, it's an audio question, our favorite kind of question. So we'll try to patch that in.
Hey, Dave and Chris. Love the show. Got a question for you. So if I want to build a static site, but use WordPress as a headless CMS for it, how do I make sure the WordPress site isn't publicly accessible online? As far as I know, there isn't a headless or API-only mode in WordPress that would prevent all the usual front-end pages and URLs from working. So potentially, people could find that WordPress site and think it was my actual website. Or search engines could find it, and then my static site is having to compete against the WordPress version for SEO. So the question is, how do I set up the WordPress site to make sure none of that happens?
Yeah, you definitely need to deal with that. I don't think it would be that difficult to do. You could put it behind basic auth, or you could, I don't know. There's stuff to do there. Like, you could definitely need to hide it. So hide it.
Yeah, I think, you know, this sort of gets into the whole serverless thing I was doing. Like, you want like some sort of keyed response to go fetch the data, right? But I don't, you know, you could always put like no robots on the whole entire.
Yeah, robots.txt it for sure. That's probably not quite good enough.
Oh, but really? Because yeah. Google's still too aggressive about robots,
yeah.
Huh?
And they say, yeah, they say like, don't count on this. I mean, you know, we're still going to index the site. I don't know. That seems like maybe not good enough, but there's stuff, you know. I looked at one recently called Git Shifter.io, which is they will spin up a WordPress site for you super quickly, and that you can run it in two different ways with Git Shifter. One of them is we'll just host your WordPress site on purpose as an API. because you're going to hit it like you would Contentful or something. We'll just have your WordPress site always up and hit it like an API, how you want to, headless style, you know? And I imagine they hide it somehow. Like, I'm sure that's part of their, that's just a default setup. If that's what you're asking them to do, I'm sure they've solved that problem. And they also have a second version of running WordPress that's really clever, which is they'll statically build it. So it'll run WordPress temporarily. It'll like spin it up serverlessly. You work with the site, get it how you looking how you want, all perfectly. And then you said, okay, done. And it will statically render all of it for you and deploy it to a Jamstack host. They'll do that hosting for you, all their push it to Netlify or whatever, which is pretty cool. So there's that too. That's the question, you know, Eric, do you need a live version of WordPress all the time? Or if it's just you, for example, you could just run WordPress locally. That could be your install of WordPress. You know, you might want to back it up somewhere, but you don't, it, maybe it just doesn't need to be online all the time.
Yeah. I mean, you could have, you could program WordPress when you hit publish, you have like an after post function or after publish function or something, and it just like goes and hits your webhook to recompile your Netlify or something like that.
Yeah.
That'd be kind of wild.
But it sounds like he's talking about using it headlessly, like API only style. So in that case, you probably do need to host it somewhere. That's one of these things that's like, it's like not compelling to me. I kind of get it. You still get to use WordPress and all, but it's like when you hit the WordPress API, whether it's the REST API or you put WP GraphQL in front of it or something, all you're getting is content. And then you need to totally rebuild a site. And that's all the only value you're getting from WordPress is that you can hit a thing and it'll spit out some content at you. You still got to build all the URLs. You got to do a blah, 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 blah. Not to mention that any plugin you use is probably useless in that way. It doesn't like deeply integrate into the site and give you probably the full value of that plugin. You know, if there's like a forms plugin or something, that's going to enqueue some CSS and enqueue some JavaScript on the regular WordPress site that makes it do its fancy thing. But then if you hit the API and get that form, all you're going to get is the HTML for that form and it won't work. So you're like, you're getting like a very slim value from WordPress when you just use it headlessly. Like you can't just decide one day, oh, I'm just going to make a view site then and hit the WordPress API for the data. You can, but you need to know that WordPress is giving you like 8% of its value if you do it that way, if you ask me. So.
No, that's a good point. Like you're ejecting, sort of like you're ejecting from what WordPress already does, you know? And so you're maybe losing some of the value. I don't know. I'm kind of like, if you're just wanting to use it headless, couldn't you just make a theme that is like renders nothing? It's just a single index.php that does nothing. like wouldn't that work? And then all your HTML views would be blank.
That's very clever, and I bet it would work.
And then all your, or you just say like, leave a message like, put your no robots in there, meta no robots, and that's all it is, right? And then now you have it's headless because it doesn't have a body, I guess. So maybe that works. But again, I think I agree with Chris. Like you're kind of. You're using WordPress only for the editor, which is gives me an idea to steal the editor and make a new product. But anyway,
doesn't you're using it?
WordPress,
yes. Just for the editor. There needs to be like cloud hosted Gutenberg because Gutenberg kicks butt.
Yeah. Anyway, but yeah, you're using it just for the editor, and I think that's, you know, again, it's good, like we said. I mean. Your mileage may vary.
I bet there's a plugin out there too. Just knowing that this is seemingly a common request is that would just like turn off WordPress other than the API routes.
Yeah. There's gotta be a plugin. So what's your idea for what is the WordPress API for then? If it's not for this stuff, what's it for? Like search or like,
oh, it's for that. It's for this. It's just I think it's easier in greenfield projects. Just know that like, okay, I'm going to build a site that I'm just going to use basically a post editor for and publish new content. And in the other, I'm going to invest no time at all in the WordPress theme. I'm not going to like make a WordPress theme and then try to replicate it elsewhere. You know, like you're just like, you totally ignore the fact that WordPress even has themes. And you just very heavily look at what the API is giving you and be like, what can I build with this API data? And then also install like no plugins, you know, just like let, which is getting trickier because it's like even Gutenberg itself without any adding any plugins, like can do some kind of fancy stuff to the front end of a site that won't work through the API, you know, like columns. Oh, Gutenberg can do columns. I find that incredibly useful. Even in day-to-day blogging, it's kind of often where I'll want to set something side by side with something, but not write my own bespoke HTML to do it because that probably won't age well. But if I use this tool that WordPress is saying, this is the WordPress is amazing at backwards compatibility. So if they make a columns thing for Gutenberg, they're going to support that HTML forever. So I'm comfortable using that, knowing that it's going to spit out some HTML that they're going to turn into columns. Well, great, but you pull in that HTML and through the API, now it's totally on you to make sure that you have CSS in place that knows about that HTML that can make it column-like. And it also makes some kind of assumptions, like the way it does columns is still Flexbox for various reasons that I've looked into. Mm. So it's like, you know, be aware of that, you know?
Yeah. So like what spits out might be a little unique.
Yeah. It's almost like wherever you use that API, you'd want to be like, WordPress, will you also please give me whatever the like canonical admin CSS is that you expect to have on the front end for these particular blocks?
Yeah.
So blocks are starting to have like their own CSS and HTML. They're like little plugins to themselves. So that I think that kind of complicates API usage.
Mm-hmm. No, that's a good, I mean, yeah, I'd be curious. I've heard people do it and then kind of like back out and just kind of go all Gatsby, you know, just on like building their own like WordPress or headless, whatever CMS kind of thing. So anyway, like they start on like doing the Gatsby plus WordPress thing. And then they're like, you know, I'm just doing Gatsby. So anyway. So your mileage, maybe.
Isn't that the big question? Is that like, how much do I care about Jamstack? Like, do I just like the idea that they're static files because that's really fast? If that's the case, looking at something like GitShifter is neat because you are getting an absolutely static site that you couldn't even host on Netlify, which there's no, it better be static because it's not going to work otherwise on Netlify, you know? So like if that's all you care about and are perfectly happy building the themes with PHP and all that stuff, knowing that the end result is Jamstack, that's a great solution for that. Or are you compelled by a Jamstack approach because it opens the door for you to then write in Vue or write in React or whatever? And I suspect that that's a bigger deal, that there's people that are just like, I just like React, so I'm going to work in Gatsby because I just like working that way. I feel more productive and powerful and et cetera than using WordPress as the source for your Gatsby site. That's why you're choosing it. It's not because you love Jamstack. It's more like because you love React.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. I got more idea. You know, if you have Netlify, if you're just using it for the CMS part, Netlify CMS is pretty good. Like a little work to get going, but if you just want the editor. But man, my dream world, here's another product. You ready? Yep. Here it is. Free advice, free startups here on the Shop Talk show. A VS Code theme that looks like a CMS. So, and it just, it's like, you could just,
wow, you're blowing my mind here today.
And it's just a folder of posts or whatever, but it looks like a CMS. And you click through and you edit Markdown and then you save it. And then it auto like sends crap up to the cloud or however you want to configure it. Maybe it's a little setting in your branch, but
that is great. That's it. That is great. There's some precedent for it because of how they turn their settings into JSON There's like a mapping between a UI and a JSON thing.
No, you could just, if you could download VS Code or maybe it's VS Press, you know, this is where the big money Microsoft needs to give me a call. VS Press.
Oh, VS Press. Yeah. Oh, that's already got a killer name.
Yeah.
Yeah. Somebody will do it. Stackbit, maybe you've seen, was a you know, it got kind of got popular because you could just click some buttons and it would scaffold out a Jamstack-y site for you. But it was kind of neat because it would be like, okay, I want to use this. I want to use Netlify CMS and I want to use this theme with this static site generator. It was kind of neat. They would support it all combined. That was kind of like their intro story. They've gotten a lot more advanced lately, and that after you've done that spinning up, they drop you into this thing called Stackbit Studio, and it's not supposed to require it works really well with the stuff they scaffold, but it's supposed to eventually kind of support any Jamstack site. It will kind of like look at your Jamstack site and kind of figure out what's going on. And it turns into like an almost Webflow kind of thing. It's not nearly as like fancy as Webflow, but it's for editing content on Jamstack sites in a very visual way. Like it figures out the mapping between your Jamstack site and where it needs to send that data to change it. So if it's like, oh, I see this data comes from this markdown file over here, so I'll make that editable. And when they change it in this very visual editor, it will change the markdown file that it needs to do that, and it changes it at the smartest level. It'll make a branch called preview in your GitHub repository and literally change the markdown file in that branch. That way, then if you click the publish button, it'll be like, okay, I'll merge the preview branch to the master branch then. Like, how clever is that, you know? And it will also know, this Jamstack site doesn't use markdown files. It uses Sanity or Contentful or something. So I'll figure out the mappings on their Contentful account and map it out that way. And then when you change things in this visual builder, it'll port that data back to that account. It's like, how the hell does that work? It's like incredible.
Yeah. No, I don't know how they like do like diffs and stuff too. It's just weird. It's like how they even figure that out.
So, I mean, if you're compelled by, I mention it because if you're compelled by Netlify CMS, which is cool and I use it on some projects, this is that, but way, way more like way beefed up version of that.
Yeah.
Whoa, that was a lot. Let's see. Should we do the last one just so we can consider it a complete?
Yeah. Less of a question, more of a tip from Russell Heimlich on episode 401. Geez, that feels like a century ago. Here he asks, how can I add a header footer without anything besides HTML? You can do this with server size includes, and the syntax, I'm going to mouth blog it here, is like angle bracket, exclamation, dash, dash, almost like a comment, then pound include virtual equals header.html, and then dash dash bracket, almost like an end of a comment. Using an HTML comment, you can include contents of another HTML page. See Geek Stuff server side includes. This should work on Apache and Nginx, which are two most common web server platforms powering the web.
I did a blog post a while back that had like eight solutions like this. Like, because my opening premise was like, I think it's a little weird that HTML itself can't do this after all this time, but I get why there's a couple of limitations there. But still, would like to do it anyway. It's such a common need. I got a 3-page site. I want the header on all three of those pages. So do it include. We've been solving this problem since the beginning of time on the web. Every server-side language has an include statement for this reason, for writing things modularly like that. And now all these static site generators have it. There must be dozens, hundreds of static site generators of some kind that have some kind of statement where you write something and it will go then get that file and include it when it's building the file. Pug and Nunjux and all of the templating languages that 11D supports and blah, blah, blah. Everybody has an include statement. Russell is pointing to the fact that your server can do it. Your Apache or Nginx thing can do it. I don't know.
I didn't know Nginx could do it, but
I didn't know that either.
Like Nginx in front of Apache. So I wonder
if that's the idea.
I hate to split hairs, but
I tried to prove this out because I had an old Apache server sitting around. I could test it and I could not get it to work. And then recently somebody wrote to me and told me why it didn't work. It was because I needed some Apache module enabled or turned on or something that I didn't have. And a lot of hosts turn it off these days because so few people do this, I think. So it's still non-trivial. Yeah. It's still not my favorite. I mean, it's kind of cool that you don't need, there's technology that's already sitting there on your server you might be able to leverage for this. This is a very old, super old school classic technique. And high five, Russell. Thanks for sending this in. It is cool to know about.
Yeah. No, it's cool. I would consider this, and I know like Filament Group uses this quite a bit, like just to kind of like, you know, get some pre-caching and stuff like that. Cause you can be like, if there's a cookie, like include this or something, like, you know, you can kind of like do server smarts here. So you can like, kind of like, if this is not the first page view or if this is the first page view, render out my critical CSS. Otherwise don't, you know, and now the page is even faster, you know? But that always like sits weird with me. And maybe one point is because like, I've not used Apache for a long time. Like, Rails is Webbrick, whatever Webbrick runs, and or Puma, or you know, I was working on a Java project that was all Tomcat, and Tomcat soup's weird, and even though that's Apache or whatever, what's an HTTP server in Node do? What's a, you know, I don't even know what brand of server that is, you know. So that's the only reason I would like. I don't think it's a panacea, but it is a cool technology, like for like Apache, like Lamp Stack, very much.
Yeah.
You can do it. I don't know. Usually in that situation, I would just rename my file index.php and include PHP.
But yeah, use a PHP include. You know what I really like? This is weird. It's a lot of buy-in for this, but Pug does an awesome job of includes because it has a nice way of... I like includes with local variables, like Rails has got, mm-hmm. you know, and lots of other mm-hmm. languages have. I think that's neat to use an include and then pass it stuff too. Even PHP can't really do that. It kind of does with globals. Like you could set a global variable right before your PHP include,
right, and then rewrite it every time.
Yeah, yeah, sure. I mean, that whatever, it's possible. But Pug does a nice job of this. I'll take the last little minute here to say that we just did an absolute crap load of work, Alex and he did on CodePen projects, which has been neglected for quite a long time on CodePen. They, you know, they 10x the speed of it, just made it a lot like just like really hardcore reliable. It's all running on serverless stuff now. So it's just, it's faster, it's smoother, it's just a much more pleasant experience to use. And we're going to keep evolving that, of course. But one of the things that CodePen Projects was always kind of good at was running Nunjux and Pug. And one of the, you know, a use case clearly in mind from the beginning of that project was, what if you need to make like a 3-page site, a 10-page site, a 40-page site or something that has this situation, like it has parts that it pieces together, blog posts and headers and footers and little componentry and stuff. Pug is freaking great at that. And so is Nunjux. I can't even decide which one I like better. I change from day to day, and CodePen Project supports it really well. So if there's like a site like that, you want to play around with these servers, you know, these include statements like that, including with, includes with local variables, try out CodePen Project. It's pretty great for it. And we rewrote all of our DNS stuff, so supporting it. So one thing CodePen Projects can do is deploy. It deploys to our own little hosting thing, but then we give you DNS information if you want to like bring your own domain name and host it. That's all working really well again. So anyway.
Nice.
Yeah.
I have a few projects. I want to find them. I think I've deployed production stuff on a project. Like, just literally, like, I made a website and I was like, that looks good. Let's make that the thing. It's perfect for when, like, you're like, I want a pen, but I want it to be multiple pages.
Yeah. Well, spoiler alert, we're going to really double, triple down on that in the coming months and years. We have lots of big plans for how cool CodePen could be, but you know, we're a small team and baby stepping it in that direction. So, oh, I'm so excited though. I feel, you know, CodePen is like what, 8.5 years old now, and we're like finally starting to run with gas here. Some decisions are starting to pay off in our long term. Like, we're here, we're, you can trust us, we're growing. Yeah.
Oh, that's great. Awesome.
All right. Thanks, Dave.
Well, cool. Yeah. Thank you. And thank you, dear listener, for downloading this in your podcatcher of choice. Be sure to start our favorite it up. That's how people find out. But show us on Twitter, Shop Talk Show, 10 6 1 8, jobhair, shoptalkshow.com/jobs, and give them new one because people want to hire people like you. And Chris, do you have anything else you'd like to read?
Shoptalkshow.com.
Or 48.